Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Rob Hopkins, co-founder of Transition Town Totnes and the Transition Network, and author of The Transition Handbook, The Transition Companion, The Power of Just Doing Stuff, 21 Stories of Transition, and most recently, From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. I have a copy of it on my desk. He presents the podcast series From What If to What Next, which invites listeners to send in their what if questions and then explores how to make them a reality. Voted one of the Independent's top 100 environmentalists, he was on Nesta and the Observer's list of Britain's 50 new radicals. He's also appeared on BBC Radio 4's For Thought and A Good Read, in the French film phenomenon Demain and its sequel Après Demain, and has spoken at TED Global and 3 TEDx events. In his spare time, he also sometimes does lino prints. Nice. So, hi, Robin. How are you?
Hi, lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I've been watching a ton of your videos. I have to say, absolutely fascinating. And I love the angle between punk and Buddhism and all the rest. So, just to start somewhere, by the way, and we'll talk about Mark E. Smith later on and a few others. But in terms of bringing anyone out there, if there's anyone out there who's unfamiliar with the transition movement, perhaps just give us an overview of that, and then I really want to get into what you're up to now, and particularly your latest book.
Okay, so the transition movement is the way that I like to think of it is that it's a movement of communities who are reimagining and rebuilding the world. So it's a movement as in you can find transition groups now in 50 countries around the world, thousands of places. There are, I think, 26 countries now that have what we call a national hub, like Transition Italy, Transition Germany, whatever. The reimagining bit is really important because a big bit of transition is about working with your community to raise their awareness about what's happening in the world, and then to say, okay, so what might the future be like if we actually did something about it? And then the rebuilding bit is, well, we don't just sit around and talk about it all the time. We actually go out and do it. The Transition Network, as much as anything, is a movement of stories. Of people in all kinds of different places doing amazing things. Someone once referred to the transition movement as hope with its sleeves rolled up, which I really like. It's a kind of a movement of engaged optimism and not waiting for anyone's permission and just getting on with it, really.
Fantastic. I love that angle of engaged optimism and hope with its sleeves rolled up. Certainly I do a lot of research into, as I know obviously you do, that issue of the difference between real hope as opposed to hypothetical optimism. That point about reimagining the world. Now, I think your latest book is absolutely fantastic, from What Is to What If. And obviously, an enormous amount about that is quite naturally, and as it states, unleashing the power of imagination to create the future we want. So just to start somewhere on that, in terms of this, as I know you write a lot about the almost at the collapse in the collective imagination, why that's happened and what the implications are. Let's just go through that.
Yeah, well, so I wrote it because I kept reading people who I really admire, like Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, really brilliant climate writers and activists. And there was a phrase that kept popping up where they would say climate change is a failure of the imagination. Is in David Wallace Wells's books, The Uninhabitable Earth. It's in all kinds of different places. But then everyone would sort of say this and then move on to something else. And I'd be sort of left there thinking, whoa, hang on, that was interesting. What did you mean by that? And it really got me thinking about why might it be that in 2021 we're having a failure of the imagination? Because climate change is fundamentally demands us to reimagine and rebuild so many things. It's, as Naomi Klein says, there are no non-radical solutions left because we left it so late. So we have to be at our most imaginative because we have to fundamentally reimagine our food system, our transport system, how our cities are going to work, how our education system is going to work, how democracy is going to work. That is, you can't build something if you can't imagine it first. And so our imagination needs to be a taut, finely honed muscle. And right now it's kind of really not that. And I think it's because, and I kind of uncovered more and more as I was researching the book, because we've kind of created a perfect storm of factors that are ruinous to the human imagination. We've seen the disappearance of play, kind of outdoor play in our culture over the last 30, 40 years. Our kids just don't do that anymore because we've made our cities so unsafe and because people are so nervous about that. Although in the book, I talk about places where people are starting to try and turn that around. We spend more and more time in front of screens, highly addictive things we carry around in our pockets, which mean that time when you and I were kids, where we might have daydreamed and gone for long walks and written little books and made things, we now just spend scrolling to the bottom, trying to get to the bottom of our Facebook feed. And the chief exec of Netflix recently said that their chief competitor as a business was sleep. And less time in nature, which is vital to our ability to be imaginative. And there is a sense in which imagination is a function of privilege. If your basic needs for food and shelter and security aren't met, if you live in the context of systemic racism and systemic economic inequality, it's very hard to live an imaginative life as well. And there are other things, you know, I feel, and I found the people over the last 30, 40, 50 years who were warning about this, who were saying, if we're going to let that stuff carry on, if we're going to just let play disappear, we're stocking up a lot of trouble for the future. If we're going to allow our attention spans to dwindle to the point that they have today, that's going to create a real problem for us. And one of the examples of that really kind of touched me actually was reading about, there's a whole chapter in the book about education, how our education system in 2021 is really makes no space for the imagination at all. It distrusts, it finds it's something that can't be measured and therefore something that we should just have nothing to do with. I found this incredible education system in Italy, in a place called Reggio Emilia, that started in 1945, which has a whole profoundly different approach to education, which almost all of the schools and educational projects I found who were saying imagination mattered, all were inspired by this place. And the thing about it is that it started in 1945, at the end of the war, as the Nazis retreated north out of Italy. And all they were left in this town was a tank, three trucks and six horses. And they sold them and raised the money to build a school. And the thing about the school was it's founding idea was, how do we create a system of education that will ensure that fascism never ever happens again? Wow. So here we are in 2021 with an education system almost entirely the opposite of Reggio Emilia, and we wonder why we're having the problems that we're having. It's not like there weren't people who saw this coming, but I feel like a lot of what we're living with in 2021 is because we have let imagination slide. And I came to feel like we recognize as a culture that if we don't, if the population don't get a good diet, we will see a rise in preventable illnesses. If we don't have a good education system, we are unable to reach our full potential. But just somewhere, just out of our field of vision, our collective imagination is shrinking. It's under assault. Some people even use this great term, the disimagination machine. We're living in a time where all of these factors together are ruinous to the imagination, and no one's talking about it. No one's noticing it. And what I wanted to do with the book was to put it back in the middle of the table and say, no, this really matters. And what would it be like if the fundamental point of education and politics and government and society was to maximize our imaginative capacity? How would it look different? So that's kind of where it came from, I guess.
that issue about, you know, how did it look different? I obviously think the book is fantastic, and I really like some of the examples you use when you're looking to how to tell, for instance, better stories in one of the chapters. And you're talking about analogy with talking with some mothers in a U.S. state who are facing real issues about, for instance, police oppression. And rather than asking people to instantly imagine how they would construct a better future, I thought it was really fascinating that the point you made about instead turning that on its head and saying to people, okay, let's now imagine that we're now in a state where things are better. What happened to make that happen? Which enables people to think in a more perhaps sort of catalytic and dynamic way, because it's just a different way of framing the question.
Yeah, it's something I do a lot as well in my own work, is that when I work with groups, is to, I always tell them, you know, I've brought along my time machine, which was something that I worked on during lockdown. I found some plans online and I've knocked this thing together with stuff I found in the garage, and it's amazing. And we're going to use it to take a trip to 2030. And it's not a 2030 that's a utopia, but it's a 2030 that is the result of us doing everything we possibly could during that time. So these 10 years, 9 years between now and then were a time of profound transition and transformation, because I find I meet so many people who work for deep transformative change, but who never allow themselves to actually believe that their work might actually bear fruit. You know, why would we, if you set out to build a house, you are able to really imagine how that house is going to work. You've got some plans, you're going to build the house. You know, we set out to try and bring out radical transformation on climate change, often at the same time believing that it's completely too late and everything's about to collapse. You know, and it's a bit like, I always say to people, you know, one of the things, you know, I watch a fair bit of football over my life, and I remember watching a game once where my team were 3-0 down at half time, and they came out and won 5-3, and it was one of the best games I ever watched. And I always say, well, I have no idea what the manager said at halftime, but I know he didn't say, well, it's too late, isn't it? There's not much point now. I think we've had it. And do you know what I mean? It's like that's not what happened. So I find that exercise of inviting people to imagine that 2030 to kind of create what in the book we call memories of the future. The poet Rilke once said, "Future must enter into you a long time before it happens," which I just love. And I see so much of my work as being around longing. How do we create longing for a post-carbon world? So that exercise is really important because it allows people to step into that future. And I've done it with small groups in workshops. I've done it with 1,500 people in a hall in Brussels, and you could hear a pin drop. And people go for this walk around. It's very emotional for some people, because society just throws dystopias at us all the time. And to make some space to say, well, what if it turned out all right? Actually, what if the next 10 years were a time of the most profound and extraordinary social, economic, cultural transformation? Things that in 2020 felt completely impossible became possible, and things really shifted. What would it be like? You know, and it's really moving, I think, for a lot of people. So there's a beautiful quote of Martin Luther King's, which I really love, when he says, "Any movement, any culture will fail if it cannot paint a picture of a world that people will want." So for me, that kind of exercise, activity, is so important in order to do that. And then once you've done that exercise with people, you can then build all kinds of things off it. Like you can say, okay, well, what were the policies that changed in 2020, 2021 that accelerated that? Or from the perspective of 2030, what are you doing in 2030? You know, describe a school to us in 2030. Describe the policies that government are making now. What are the values that are underpinning government? You know, you can then really kind of play with it once you've created that vision. And I have a book as well about an amazing exercise that was developed in the transition movement, along with an organization called Encounters Arts, where you actually build that future with cardboard and sticky tape and string, and you build a three-dimensional version of it, and you trade in it, you live in it, you occupy it, and it's fantastic. So the power of creating a vision of the future, which is as multi-sensory as possible, is something we've only really started to scratch the surface of, I think.
Absolutely. And I think also another one that you mentioned, the sort of various quotes. I mean, the book where you quote the educational reformer, John Dewey, who describes the ability to look at things as if they could be otherwise as being such a vital sort of a perspective to have. Just going back, perhaps slightly, you're talking earlier on about play and the importance of it and the way that play has been so devalued in society or in most societies around the world. I mean, I've done a ton of research into this. And I thought it was fascinating, for instance, you know, Brian Sutton Smith, who wrote numerous books, including The Ambiguity of Play, has said, you know, the opposite of play isn't work, it's depression. And you know, another sort of famous Sartre saying, you know, play is what you do when you feel that you're most free, you're most voluntary. Can I say another one also? Just one of you mentioned about schooling. Can I say that you know, Jean Piaget said, you know, play is the work of childhood.
Absolutely. And there were, you know, I've written a few different books, as you mentioned at the beginning, and most of them include a section about climate change, which means I have to go and read the science about climate change, which is always heartbreaking. And I have to say, I research about the decline of, like, the state of health of the imagination in our education system, almost as heartbreaking, actually. And what happens when kids aren't allowed to play. There was that fascinating study that I talk about in the book where there was a school shooting. Some guy in Texas climbed to the top of the building and shot 40 people or something off the top of the building. Then a researcher interviewed him and loads of other people who were involved in sort of large-scale killings in America. And one of the things that they had in common was that they weren't allowed to play as children. And the impacts of a childhood where you're not allowed to play. I think in the book about Donald Trump that his niece Mary Trump wrote, she talked about something very similar. You know, that actually when children are not allowed to play and have that kind of free play, you know, not a play where everything's like, right, let's play something with rules, but that kind of let's pretend sort of play is so important. Because it teaches kids how to cooperate, it teaches kids how to resolve conflict, it teaches kids how to take risks. And if we produce a generation of adults, of kids who can't take risks, then we're producing a generation of adults who can't take risks. And that's the last kind of thing we need to be producing right now.
Can I just say, in terms of the climate change issue, or the climate sort of emergency issue. Now, I mean, one of the, obviously the epic movements of our time, Extinction Rebellion, are a movement I know that you're very much involved with. So, where are you at the moment from the point of view of how you perceive where Extinction Rebellion are? Because naturally, they, you know, if you say exploded into the public consciousness effectively in late 2018, then really 2019. After a year in which external, visible, public space protest naturally hasn't happened, how does a movement like that effectively keep going when protest cannot physically happen?
No, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm probably not the best person to answer. I mean, I'm not involved actively in Extinction Rebellion. My wife is very involved in Extinction Rebellion. She's been arrested 4 times. I'm very proud of her. She's much braver than I am in terms of kind of campaigning. I don't know. I think it is really difficult because that is the express model of XR is to fill the streets with people. And then they're also a movement that feels very socially responsible. They're not just going to rush out now and say, never mind, like, you know, sort of anti-lockdown campaigners or something. So, so I don't know. I think there is that there's a lot of reflection going on within XR about what to do next. I'm sure they'll be back. I mean, you know, they present a really powerful impulse and a really powerful constituency. And for me, it's been really fascinating during lockdown. I've done lots of, since the book came out, I've been doing a lot of online webinars with transition groups, with XR groups, talks about the stuff in the book. And it's been really interesting that all a lot of the transition groups are saying, yeah, maybe we need to be, you know, being a little bit more like Extinction Rebellion, a bit more kind of, you know, confrontational or whatever. And then people in XR saying, maybe we need to be a bit more like transition and a bit more rooted in doing things where we are. And it's tricky for the transition movement too, because transition is fundamentally about getting people together in spaces. You know, you can do a bit online, but the magic of transition happens when you fill a hall with people and you facilitate it in a way that there's all kind of serendipitous connections that then emerge and impulses to go off and do stuff. And that doesn't really work online. So all of the different movements for change, whether they are kind of big, bold, beautiful no movements or big, bold, beautiful yes movements, you know, however they do. So actually one of the things that we're doing in transition is over the first 3 weeks of March, we're doing an event called the What Next Summit, which is going to be bringing together a wide range of movements. If people are listening and are interested, if they just Google What Next Summit, Transition Bounce Forward, it's running over 3 weeks and is going to be looking at a lot of that stuff. You know, how do we all work together better as movements? How do we facilitate this in such a way that we can put the imagination at the heart of what we're doing and do some really creative work and move forward a lot faster? But in terms of Extinction Rebellion, I'm probably not the best person to talk to about that.
Okay, can I just ask, and certainly the summit sounds absolutely fantastic. And just remind me again, what date does that actually start?
So it's going to run from the 3rd to the 20th of March. There's not things on every day. They're mostly clustered around the end of the week. But the first week is What Is Week, which is where we're bringing together lots of different movements and organizations to say, okay, where are we now? What is happening? What are the shoots of the future that we can already see? The second week is the What Next Week, which is about what happens when we bring imagination into the mix. What does that then unlock? And then the third week is the What Next Week, which is about how do we move forward from here? What can we build from here going forward? Mm-hmm. If people are interested, have a look at transition-bounceforward.org.
Excellent. Okay. One of the other points you mentioned just now was when you're talking it was about the meeting in the local hall, the village hall, the town hall, or whatever. I mean, citizens assemblies have been a really, really important tool of organisation used by, you know, movements the world over. I remember going to an excellent talk by Josie Holt from XR talking about citizen assemblies. So from the point of view of that and how you actually go about organising grassroots initiatives on that, perhaps just talk us through that, if you like, the actual practicalities of how that is done.
Well, citizens assemblies really work best when the organization that has the power to make the changes undertakes that they are going to take on the findings of a citizens assembly. That's what happened in Ireland. So they had three there, one about abortion, one about same-sex marriage, and one about something else, which were facilitated over a series of weekends with people who were chosen by sortition. So like they would be for jury duty, they were chosen kind of at random, but in such a way that when they were put together as a group, they represented the diversity in that society in terms of gender and age and employment and so on. So you kind of create a kind of a mini version of the population as best as you can. And then their instruction is, like on jury duty, you're not here to act for yourself. You're here to act on behalf of your peers. And then they are given the best information, the best evidence, the best experts, and the space and time to digest that. And then invited to come up with, to consider various policies. And a citizens' assembly, it seems to me, works best with really good facilitation. You know, Gil Scott-Heron had his very famous song, Revolution Will Not Be Televised. I'm a great believer that if he was working now, he might do a song called The Revolution Will Be Well Facilitated, because it's one of the key things that we need to be building into our movements and our networks is really good facilitation. And I've been to a couple of citizens' assemblies and I've presented at a couple. And one of them I found really disappointing because if you take say 50 people or 100 people representing their local community in a microcosm, who It may not have really thought about climate change very much, may not have thought about what we're going to do about it. It was like they had the first weekend, they were just bombarded with information. 22 speakers, bam, 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 transport, climate, da, 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 da. And then the next week they came back and then they had to make decisions about what they were going to do. I feel like if you really, when you really understand climate science, when you spend time among climate scientists who are able to paint the picture in its full entirety, and that really lands in you, you need a bit of time to digest that. For me, I always talk about it as being my kind of dark night of the soul. You know, it took a while to land. And the one I went to, people were sitting around the table on the morning of the second weekend, say, and the Hope facilitators were saying, so do you think we should be aiming for zero carbon by 2050 or 2040 or 2030? Is 2030 too ambitious? Maybe it should be 2040. And I'm thinking, you know, if you'd really understood the climate science the previous time, you would know that even, you know, 2040 is a sort of 3.5 degree world. It's absolutely catastrophic, you know. So there needs to be some process, facilitated kind of emotional support process of really understanding it. And if you look at the one that was done in France, that Cyril Dion, who was one of the people who created the film Demain, which you mentioned at the beginning, he was one of the people who designed the Citizens Assembly there, which I think ran over 12 weekends. It was quite a commitment for people, quite a long process. And that was that came up with 147 recommendations, which Macron agreed to implement 143 of, or something, you know. So
wow,
that felt like a process that was really deep and really, really rich. It's something that takes a lot to organize something like that, but there's a risk that they can be really, really heady, and it seemed to me like if I was facilitating a citizens assembly, it would be a lot more kind of embodied and a lot more recognizing that dumping that kind of information on people, it's a big thing for people. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can't keep all that stuff in your head, and I know because I've tried. you know, it doesn't work like that. So I think citizen assemblies are a really powerful and important model, but they have to work in the context where whoever is calling them is committed to taking on whatever their findings are, and the hand facilitated is fundamentally important to their success, I think.
Mm. Then also, just going back to one of the points you made just now, with regards to, you mentioned about sort of emotional support, and certainly there's been, I think, a lot spoken about this issue with regards to mental well-being amongst those, particularly in the context of this conversation in the climate and ecological movement, if you can put it like that, who are, when faced with the realization of just how bad things are, can very soon find themselves in difficult territory on a personal level from the point of view of just taking on board effectively how cataclysmic things are. And yet on your side, and just giving a quote from the book, one of the reviews says, you know, so the founder of the International Transition Towns movement asks why true creative positive thinking is in decline, asserting it's more important now than ever, and suggests ways that we in our communities can revive and reclaim it. So just that issue of having a positive mindset despite the realization of just how tough things are, as someone like Gail Bradbrook or Roger Hallam would put it, just perhaps talk about that, about how you build in and talk around retaining or building positivity when faced with, you know, a catastrophe.
Potential extinction.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In terms of an extension issue.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like if you spend 100% of your time being giddily optimistic, then you're probably kidding yourself a bit, and you're probably not really paying attention. And at the same time, if you spend all of your time being massively pessimistic and feeling like nothing can ever happen, you're paralyzing yourself. You know, I mean, I go to France and Belgium, and I meet people who are in, there's a big movement there called the Collapsology movement, which I guess here the manifestation of it is the sort of Jim Bendel deep adaptation kind of collapse is now inevitable kind of crowd, which I don't really go along with and subscribe to. And I feel like that, of course, it's really important. You know, if you like Paul Hawkins says, you know, if you read the climate science and you're not a pessimist, then you haven't read it properly. Read it again. But at the same time, if you've spent any time among the people all over the world who are trying to do something about it and you're not an optimist, then you don't have a heart, you know. And that's kind of where I sit with it, you know. For me, you know, I can completely understand why people become completely overwhelmed and paralyzed by what's happening, and I have moments like that myself, and I think everybody does. Of course they do, because the science is terrifying. And if you aren't terrified, then I would suggest you're not paying attention, and you might want to read The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells for a bit of a reality check. But at the same time, most of those scenarios are the scenarios that are based on us not doing anything. They're based on business as usual. And, you know, there are no scenarios in which climate change doesn't happen. Climate change has started. We are living in a world where the climate is already changing. But every fraction of a degree that we don't warm by is massively, massively important. And so for me, I feel like, yes, it's absolutely appropriate that there is a conversation that says, what if everything collapsed? And in the same way that in Buddhism, you know, it's seen as that view of impermanence and the transitory nature of things and stuff is really important worldview, to, you know, to have an understanding of neoliberal capitalism as a very fragile edifice is really important. But what I always say when I meet people, collapse people, is like, okay, yeah. Firstly, there's a question. What if everything collapsed? Yeah, important question, really important. But also, what about the question of what if what we were to see over the next 10 years was a revolution of the imagination? What if all of the movements who were working on this stuff were able to work together and collaborate in the most phenomenally unprecedented way? What if we were to see a kind of a cascade of positive change that built and built, and institutions that in 2021 feel completely permanent actually dissolved and disappeared over that period of time? You know, if we shut down that possibility, it's never going to happen. We need to keep that possibility open and talk to it and tell stories about it and bring it to life with our imagination and our collective storytelling, because that's where that possibility lies, I think.
I think also I thought it was really interesting how you pose questions, for instance, you know, what if we made refugees feel welcome? So that issue of just an absolutely deep and positive change on a societal level of something as absolutely fundamental and needed as that.
Yeah, it's part of that conversation about what if questions matter so much. Because a good what if question, I always like to think of it as being like in Alice in Wonderland, where she's too big to get through the door. She can't get in there yet, but she can look through the door and she can see a different future. So a good what if question kind of contains that sort of invitation. It's like a taste. There's a quote in the book by Antanas Mockus, which is something like, a good what if question is like writing the first half of a really audacious question on the blackboard and trusting people's ability to respond to it, or something like that, you know. I draw a lot of inspiration actually from the movements for from a lot of the kind of black movements for change and the kind of Afrofuturist movements and the for example, the prison abolition movement, which is a phenomenal thing, which has kept alive for 40, 50, 60 years, that question of what if there were no prisons? I mean, what if there were no prisons? Really? I mean, you know, hold that space to think about that. What would need to change in society for there to be no prisons? How would justice need to work? How would education system work? How would we support people in education? It's a fascinating question, and there are lots of people who really inspire me from that kind of world. There's a woman called Mariame Kaba, who's a big prison abolitionist activist there, who she said in an interview I read with her, we must imagine while we build, always both. And sort of how do you keep a good what if question alive over time is something that really, really intrigues me. And there's also the whole kind of world of what's called speculative fiction, which is people writing stories about the future and how to bring them alive. So there's that whole kind of world of people as well who write about fiction and change. And there's somebody who I love called Walida Imarisha, who wrote a book called Octavia's Brood, or kind of collated a book called Octavia's Brood of writers of color writing speculative fiction about the future. And she said, whenever we try to envision a world without war, without violence, without prisons, without capitalism, we are engaging in speculative fiction. All organizing is science fiction. I love that. All organizing is science fiction. And I feel like that capacity to tell stories is really important. And that what we've seen over the last sort of particularly the last 15, 20 years, but kind of since the 60s, in that we no longer have I have a dream politicians, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, people like that, who were able to fill the future with visions and stories about the future. And it could be amazing. We could do this. We could do this. We could do this. We don't have that anymore. And that's left a vacuum in front of us, which people then fill with much more kind of fear-based, well, let's go backwards. The future looks too scary, so let's go backwards. Take back control. Make America great again. We see this kind of nostalgic politics that fills that space instead. And it feels so important to me that actually we are able to become so much better in our movements at telling stories about what that future would be like in a way that people can almost taste it and smell it and feel it. We need to be bringing the I have a dream back into how we campaign and how we do politics.
Mm. I think there's a lot of talk, isn't there, in the world of think tanks and the sort of the policy wonks, whereby the left are suspicious of the future at the moment, while the right always try to reclaim the past. You know, that typical populist sort of a strategy that they tend to use. Just talk again a bit about your influences or other influences. So again, I thought it was just excellent in the books. I was looking through there. So the ones you mentioned, everyone from Marky Smith to the Marty and Naomi Klein, Jonathan Richman, the Situationists, and Adam Curtis and Nick Drake. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I'm always somebody who likes to wear my influences on my sleeve, really. And every book I've written has a whole bit at the beginning. I love, one of my favourite albums is by DJ Shadow, the first record they did called Introducing. And I always kind of grew up with a lot of hip hop stuff and how Public Enemy did the same thing on their record sleeves. They would just do these voluminous lists of and stuff to people who had inspired them. And so I always do that in my book. So there's a lot of mentions of music I'm listening to while I'm writing. And particularly in From What Is to What If, I wanted to try and capture who are the people who have sparked my own imagination over my life, whether it's artists or writers or musicians, because I'm very, I listen to lots of music and I grew up listening to endless different things and read lots and very kind of curious for stuff. So yeah, I enjoyed writing that list. It could have gone on and on and on. I think I was quite restrained, really, under the circumstances.
That could be the next one, the book of lists. But of, you mentioned the Mighty and Naomi Klein. I remember I interviewed her, or she very kindly gave me some quotes from years ago when I first met her, when she wrote, well, actually before she'd written No Logo, some stuff I was doing then for The Face. What about the issue of who are the inspiring writers of the moment in terms of the current crop of writers, irrespective of their age, but the ones perhaps who are coming through, either the writers or the thinkers that you look around you and think, well, there's someone that really wasn't on the scene a couple of years ago and they've really got something to say. Anyone there you can think of who you think is particularly compelling?
Yeah, well, you asked me in your invitation to bring some books that I was reading at the moment, which some of which
bring it on.
Yes. So this is a book you mentioned, Marky Smith. I'm reading a book called Have a Bleeding Guess by Paul Hanley, which is the story of Hex Induction Hour, which is one of, I think, the greatest album that The Fall ever made. I'm a big fan of The Fall, and that's a really interesting book. This is Mariana Mazzucato, called The A Moonshot Guide to Changing Capitalism, which I'm finding really interesting.
Yeah, she's great, isn't she? She's really, really on fire.
Yeah. This is a book by Kate Soper called Post-Growth Living for an Alternative Hedonism, which is a really nice book, which kind of taps into some of the stuff that David Fleming, who was a real influence of mine, in his book Lean Logic, talks about, this idea of when we're trying to imagine a post-growth, post-carbon future, how can we imagine it as a place of carnival and celebration and delight? And I love this idea of alternative hedonism that she writes about in there. This is something that I'm reading, which I love, which is by a guy called Andy Friend, called Revilius & Co., about Eric Revilius, who was an English artist, woodblock maker, and watercolorist in the 1930s, 1940s, which I just love. I just love his work. And it's so interesting because you mentioned that I make lino cuts. What's really interesting in here is about when people went to art school in the 1930s. Now, when people go to art to do an art degree, you know, it's a lot about concepts. It's a lot about ideas. And in the 1930s, when you went, you learned lettering and watercolors and oil and printmaking and design and illustration. And it was a phenomenal rounded education. And from this book, you get a real sense of that. This is...
What was that book called again?
It's called Resilius and Co. It's also the most beautiful, physically the most gorgeous book. I just absolutely love it. This is by someone called Marianne Wolfe, called Reader Come Home, The Reading Brain in a Digital World. It's all about what happens when a society stops reading so many books and the digital world takes over. Is it just like moving from one media to another, or actually is it having much deeper impacts on our thinking, on our imagination? This is a book by Natasha Marin that came out very recently called The Black Imagination, which is really fascinating. She did a big exhibition somewhere in the US or Canada, I think, which was inviting people of color to share their talk about imagination. And it's a collection of their reflections and stories, which I'm really loving. And this is one of the best things I read for ages, called Emergent Strategy by Adrienne Marie Brown, who's one of the most fascinating young activists, writers of color, who writes about activism in the context of permaculture and ecology and intersectional issues around race and class and sexuality in a way that's really accessible and beautiful. And I'm very much trying to make a conscious effort to read a lot more people of color. And the other one I read recently was The New Jim Crow by Michelle someone, which is all about sort of mass incarceration in the US, which is fascinating. Just finished reading Black and British by David Olusoga, which is brilliant as well, all about the history of black people in the UK, which I think everybody should read.
I
have such a huge pile of books by the side of my bed that there's always a danger it's going to fall on me in the night and do me an injury, because I'm endlessly curious for new books. And the one that I'm really waiting to get hold of is Mariame Carber's new book, which is all about prison abolition. And I'm really looking forward to that, because she's an extraordinary writer and activist.
Yeah. What a fantastic and eclectic selection there. Just one of the points you made there when you were talking about the Emergent Strategy book, and just a point you might have mentioned briefly earlier on, but just to be clear about this. So again, for the uninitiated, permaculture, just clarify that, please.
Okay. Yeah, permaculture. So I was a teacher of permaculture for about 12 years or something. And permaculture is something that has been a profound influence on my life and on my thinking. It's a design system for how do you take the lessons we can learn from ecology about how ecological systems work and apply those to how we design things now. So it's a design system for how you use those principles from nature to assemble a farm, a garden, a window box, an economy, design a house, but in such a way that, you know, we have become so detached from learning from how nature works. So, and because we're so bad at designing things, we have to use energy to make up for all the things that we've done wrong. So if we're able to design systems that are modeled on nature, you know, you never go for a walk in a woodland and see somebody out there weeding it and watering the trees. You know, it's a self-regulating system. So how do we take learnings from how those systems self-regulate and apply them to the systems we design? It's very kind of positive, solutions focused. And what I loved about it was that it also distills out what you really need to know. Like, do you really need to study soil science for 3 years at university to know how to grow good carrots? Probably not. So it kind of distills out the wisdom that we need right now in order to do that stuff better.
Fantastic. I can imagine that also it's why, of the many, I mean, fantastic quotes or should say recommendations for the book, the mighty Kate Raworth, author of Donut Economics, says, I couldn't stop reading this book and ideas just wouldn't stop popping into my head. Rob Hopkins puts imagination back at the heart of future dreaming, offering us an irresistible invitation to dream bigger and then make those dreams a reality. For anyone seeking a renowned sense of possibility, this one's for you. Nice.
Yeah. No. I sent her the draft. She was going to New Zealand. She doesn't fly very much, but she was invited to, I think, meet with the government of New Zealand. And so she was like, "All right." So I think she got on the plane and she read the book the whole way. And I got this email from her sitting at the airport in New Zealand, waiting to be picked up at the airport, saying, "Oh, I love it. It's great. I really love it." So that's always nice to get that kind of feedback. You asked about big ideas and big things for now. You know, donut economics is absolutely one of the most fundamentally important ideas of now, and that's definitely a book that would go into my book pile as well.
I'm just linking into something that again you mentioned her and not being a big fan of flying. Again, one of the many, many what if things or questions that you pose are naturally, you know, what if we phased out aviation and brought forward slow travel?
Yeah, I stopped flying in 2006 when I went with my wife to go and see An Inconvenient Truth. And at the end of the cinema, when the credits are coming up over all those glaciers all sort of caving in on themselves, we were like, okay, well, we need to change something. What are we going to change? And we decided not to fly. And, you know, we've started this or been involved in catalyzing this movement now in 50 countries without flying around and visiting all of them. And, you know, it has been really interesting. All the people I've known in the activist world who said, yeah, well, you're very idealistic, Rob. And, you know, of course, you can't really do organizing and campaigning without flying. And, you know, if international conferences are really important and we have to fly to them. And academics will tell me, well, of course, you know, we have to fly and give our papers to these different international conferences. Interesting now, the last year, what we found is that maybe we don't need to. And actually, we can just change the systems by which we do things and things can still go on okay. And maybe rather than flying all of your team to Paris for a breakfast meeting, you just do it on Zoom and you stay at home. And actually, you know, things still work. So, you know, I've been very, I stopped flying and have been very kind of outspoken about it. And, you know, for all of the people who've said to me, well, that's naive and ridiculous. And of course you can't. Actually, I've had lots and lots of people who've said that was what inspired me to do the same thing too. So I think there is a big power to kind of living your talk and telling other people about it.
Mm-hmm. And just as we begin to finish off, and it's been obviously a fascinating conversation, thank you so much. One of the actually very brief videos that you also put out amongst a big sort of collection of them, I thought was fascinating was your view from 2030 and saying, so this is where you are, where we are. You talk about things like there being the civic imagination office, schools having eliminated testing, play being encouraged, and children having gone through what you termed a great reskilling. So perhaps just to return to that slightly, what were you suggesting there?
Well, that book is that video is trying to bring to life the opening six pages of the book, which are kind of my walk through a day in the life in 2030. And which has been really nice. I've had lots of emails of people who said we started our conference with reading that out, or, you know, all different places where people have used that. It seems to really resonate, particularly the bit where it says that there are now lots of new bakeries in the city, which were created as part of a citywide mental health strategy when they realized that baking is the new Prozac, which is actually a phrase I got from the Real Bread campaign, from a document by them. So the thing about that story is pretty much everything that is in that story is already happening somewhere. You know, like the very little of it is some Rob fantasy. You know, you can point to bits of that in different places. And the stuff about education, is the idea that we need to have an education system which is much more embodied, where kids learn physical skills. There was a story in the paper the other day about the family where during lockdown, the dad and worked with his son to build a Saxon house in the back garden, and they learned all the different skills that they needed, and the wattle and the daub and the cobbing and the green woodwork and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, well, and everyone was going, oh, isn't this marvelous? This is really great, good educational thing. And I'm thinking, well, okay, so then why don't we get the kids to build buildings at school? You know, there are so many kids failed by school, particularly boys, but not always, you know, who, for whom sitting in rows, some of my kids were really like this too, sitting in rows every day, learning stuff, it's just not how they learn at all. They need to use their hands, be in their body, move around. They've got so much energy they need to do something with. You know, I think everybody should leave school knowing how to grow 10 vegetables to a basic level of proficiency. They should know how to use a chisel. They should know how to cook. You know, all of that stuff should be, we've been overrun by this idea that we need to test everything and evaluate and measure everything. And if we don't, then you're one of those really smart kids that gets A's, or you're one of those kids that might scrape a C, or you're a bit of a fail, really, and all the school wants is to get those kind of grades. And we are doing such a massive disservice. And I don't say that as any kind of criticism of teachers. There are so many teachers I meet who are just as heartbroken by the whole system and having to work within it and would love more creativity and more freedom, like in Iceland, where basically Finland or Iceland, where they have that incredible education system where basically teachers are educated for an extra year up to a master's level, and then they're just allowed to teach. And they don't test everything, and they don't measure everything. And they're one of the most sort of highly attaining countries in the world. So that idea of a great reskilling, I think, doesn't just apply to school kids, because it's something where if we are going to create a more resilient, more localized, low carbon future, all of us need to have more skills. How do we repair stuff? How do we cook better? How do we grow things? How do we, how do we sharpen a pair of scissors? You know, rather than chucking him in a bin and buying a new pair of scissors, you know. So all of that stuff is going to be a part of this. But the beautiful thing of that is, as someone who worked in teaching for a while, teaching adults when I was teaching permaculture, and who visits lots of places, I've never met anyone who says, do you know, my life was doing all right until I learned how to grow lettuce. And then really it was downhill all the way from then. And, you know, the day that I learned how to plumb my own bathroom, really just everything fell apart. You know, it's not like that. It's something where I feel like when we meet each other as people, you know, I spent, when I was 20, 21, or something like that, I lived in Italy, in a very rural part of Italy, with lots of kind of farmers who'd grown up and who were always like in a very resilient rural kind of economy that doesn't really exist there anymore. And there is such a difference when you meet people who know that whatever problem they encounter, they can probably turn their hand to it. And they can figure it out. And then the people immediately around them, they know they've got the support they need. And that kind of can-do, practical spirit, when people meet each other in that way, there's a completely different quality to it than when we all meet each other as people who really can barely boil an egg and can't sew anything and can't fix anything and are completely dependent for all of that stuff. So I feel like the next 10, 20 years will also need to be accompanied by a big process of all of us learning to be more practical, and teenagers learning what all of their 10 fingers are for, not just their console connected thumbs.
I was about to say thumbs up to that, but I know exactly what you mean, Rob. Well, look, just to finish off, I'll just give a final quote from the book, and that is this. And you mentioned in the book that I opened it with a quote by Susan Griffin, and you said you'll close it with one, which is, "No one can stop us from imagining another kind of future, one which departs from the terrible cataclysm of violent conflict, of hateful divisions, poverty and suffering. Let us begin to imagine the worlds we would like to inhabit, the long lives we will share, and the many futures in our hands." Beautifully put, has to be said.
Amen.
So just so everyone's entirely clear where they can track you down, just remind us, go on then, Rob, so where can they track you down on...
So robhopkins.net is the blog that I do, and there you can find all of the interviews that were done for the book, all 100 and whatever interviews I did, were all posted as I went along on the blog. So if you read the book and you think, "Ooh, she sounds interesting, you know, Rosalie Summerton at Art Angel in Dundee sounds interesting," you can go on the blog and you can find the full interview I did with them. Transitionnetwork.org is if you want to find out more about the transition movement. The podcast that I do, as you mentioned, From What If to What Next, is on Patreon at patreon.com/FromWhatIfToWhatNext. And it's £3 a month. You get 4 podcasts a month, and you get to be part of shaping the conversations that we have. And so for about the price of 2 packets of chocolate digestives, you do your imagination the most enormous service and give it a big stretch a few times a month.
Well, look, Rob, that's absolutely fantastic. So what I can say is to Rob Hopkins, the co-founder of Transition Town Totnes and Transition Network, author of numerous books, including the utterly brilliant From What Is to What If, Unleashing the Power of Imagination to Create the Future We Want. Thank you. Very much indeed.
Thank you. My absolute pleasure. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.